jump into Ecclesiastes tonight and get it over with. We're going to be looking at the entire sixth chapter of Ecclesiastes. It's a fairly short chapter. And when we get done with it, it'll put us like halfway through the book. And we're starting to make a transition. There's been a lot of what the writer is telling us, that's wrong about life under the sun without God in it. He's now started making, after this chapter, more of a transition into the things that are right, of putting God in our life and how it would be so much better, concluding with chapter 12 of the whole duty of man, considering fearing God and keeping his commandments. He's still on a certain theme here, feels that there's still more to be said to Israel to help the covenant people get their bearings on the question, what is the worth of wealth? And I think it might be overkill, but if you look at everything we've been looking at, he's still attacking it from different facets, different angles, whatever. And especially since we considered last week, it's something that's a prevalent problem for back then, at any time, even now, where people have a tendency to put their hope in wealth and riches instead of in God. It is an endeavor to curb envious thoughts that might spring up in their hearts from their present impoverished state. These should be welcome observations to the people now in our culture who are coming from a time of plenty and entering into a period of, looks like economic recession, if not total depression. So how do you adjust? Well, this is what's nice about Ecclesiastes and all the wisdom literature. It helps you in just every aspect of life, no matter which way life goes. Especially among Christians who know that the Lord taught that life does not consist in what a person has as possessions. Luke 12:15. So starting with verse 1, there is an evil which I have seen, the preacher says, under the sun and is prevalent among men. To begin this discussion on the value of riches with the statement, there is an evil, ought to help men get their bearings. Is this something that's really important in life, or it's something maybe we should be very careful with when we consider which way we want to bend our lives to go? And note the familiar phrase, under the sun, to know that the discussion concerns the evil that can develop without God in the picture. And it is also stated that this evil is prevalent. Rabbi means something that's great, greatly common among men. Okay. So he goes, a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires. Notice, God has given, well, look at this, but God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is a vanity and a severe affliction. The preacher leads with a paradox calculated to remove any misapprehension men may have in regard to riches. First of all, when he describes, someone said that a paradox is truth standing on its head to get attention. Usually as you look at a paradox, it's something that's kind of weird, and you might look, that doesn't make sense, or that can't be right, but it is. It is a truism. And so we're looking at it describes a man whom God has blessed. Okay, for all that is good comes from God, and he's given him riches, health, and honor, so that the guy lacks for nothing in the broadest scope of riches and wealth. He even enjoys a good reputation, a good name, having honor before men as one of his notable acquisitions. This is all from God. But here's the rub. It's an ideal case to make the contrast all the more striking. The particular evil that the author has in mind is that with all these blessings, God has also cursed him to make it impossible for him to enjoy all these things. So the rich man under the sun, on the one hand, never gets beyond the painful process of accusation, acquisition, and stays in the thraldom of his avaricious drive. We looked at that last week. Here's somebody who's driving, he seeks riches, but that's all he's doing. He's just seeking. He's driven by it. His soul can't get enough. On the other hand, God has not given it to him to the ability or the gift to enjoy it. This is accomplished by either some calamities either inflicted by God or the culmination of a softened living that allows foreigners, those of another nation, to enjoy his gain. So we're in a transition period later in Israel's life as a nation, where they possibly under captivity, or they've come out and about to go back in again, sometime where the later prophets are beginning to condemn the people for what they're doing. And this is something, you know, we could look at our own lifestyles. You know, you can be so into gathering riches and stuff like that, you begin to soften life. You know, you think everything's going to go on the way it is, and you don't make, you know, any kind of thought toward defense of your nation or your family or your, you know, your home or whatever. You get too much caught up in the good life and forget that it's, you know, it's something that's a gift and can be taken away at any time. Think of the overthrow of the Persians by Alexander, which the author may very well have in mind in this case. Also, you know, Daniel prophesied about it. You go through Daniel, he's going through all these, you know, nations, you know, following nations, you know. So where does the people of God fit in all this? And how do they adjust to it? There are also many times when the nations have devastated God's people, as in Psalm 79:3, where God has sent nations in order to teach Israel a lesson. So if a man fathers 100 children, lives many years, however many they be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say, better the miscarriage than he. The man in question may have had a good fortune to beget numerous offsprings, which was always deemed a blessing in ancient times. This is why, this is one of the blessings that God was going to give to Abraham. I'll make of you many nations. You know, so to have all these descendants was a blessing of God, along with long life and even greater fortune. Yet his soul derives no satisfaction from the good, wealth, offspring, and length of days. If in the overthrow by foreigners, his wealth is made spoil, his children are made slaves, and he himself does not even get a respectable grave. In fact, on that last, this is something probably, you know, the smarter individuals have understood. Remember the quote on Cyrus's grave? O man, who will come? I know you will come. My name is Cyrus, and I've given the Persians their empire. Do not begrudge me then this little bit of land that now covers my body. You know, they know they could lose everything, every trace of themselves with time. Okay, the word soul here that's used, nephesh, refers to all the functions through which life is maintained or strengthened. Can also be translated, so you could have numerous definitions, so you have to tell by the context which definition to put in. This same word, translated soul here, can also be translated appetite, as in verse 7, or desires in verse 9. But the root is always the same. Truly, as one looks at the carnage of a battlefield and all the corpses left for the carrion, then under the sun, it does seem better to have died at birth. Okay. For it comes in futility, goes in obscurity, and its name is covered in obscurity. What is the it? Well, that's that miscarriage. Okay. It's given a kind of a neuter function here, but verses 4 through 6 explain why the miscarriage is more fortunate. It, or he, who comes in futility, has no purpose, okay, never, you know, becomes even a baby and goes into obscurity, darkness, nothing known about him. It never sees the sun, it never knows anything, but it is better off than he, that is this rich man who's got all this stuff but never enjoyed it. Although he never acquires a name and never sees the sun, it is spared the vexation of the unsatisfying pursuit of riches. And even if the other man, the rich man, lives 1,000 years, twice, and does not enjoy good things, do not all go to one place. Since the author has already made a point that long life is a blessing, he cannot be making the point that no life is better. Rather, he's saying, from does not enjoy good things, offers the conclusion that if one lives two lives, yet does not take the time to derive the blessings from them, then both the miscarried child and the unfruitful man are in the same place, and neither can make up for it where they're going. Does this have any relevance with us? Yeah. You have to stop and look. What are you doing with your life? I mean, sit there and watch TV till 3 o'clock in the morning, play video games all day long, you know, just look for fun. You know, at some point, you got to ask yourself, what am I doing here? You know, is there a grand scheme? Is there a purpose? Or do I just come and with so many other, you know, nameless individuals go into eternity and long forgotten? when we think of the billions of people that have lived on this planet since the very beginning, how many of them do you know about? Okay. And bigger question, does God know you? Even if you do make a name for yourself, famous or infamous, you know, so that people remember you, you know, the big question is, does God remember you? I mean, your life is a gift. Have you taken the time to actually see life the way God meant for you to enjoy it? You know, to take, you know, to go in daily prayer before God, to think about the blessings and how to use blessings, you know, to enrich your own life and also to serve God to the best of your ability. If you're not doing that, your life is lived under the sun, and quite frankly, it's better if you've never been born. By the time you get on your deathbed, you look back and go, what have you done with it? Have you really wasted it? Have you just killed time and killed your own soul doing nothing in service to God? All a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. Dealing with the subject of riches and their vanity, the author throws stronger light upon his point. Here he finds a particular flaw in the nature of man under the sun, which makes the satisfaction to be derived from the labor for riches, you know, virtually impossible. Since we have pointed out that the word for appetite here, verse 7, is the same as for soul, the expression for his mouth does not imply just the baser hungers, whatever, but also higher ones as well. He starved for that. Clearly, a soul that has never learned to say enough has departed from proper functioning and is pitifully damaged. If that's all you do, I can't get enough, I can't get enough. In fact, recently I saw in the news that science has discovered people who literally eat themselves to death because their bodies have no mechanism to tell them when they're full. You know, pitiful picture of a little kid that just kept eating all the time. People have to watch it, okay? For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? The wise man, Kakam here, and the poor man are often used, you know, throughout, you know, Ecclesiastes and other, you know, Psalms, and are here a reference to the people of God. Whereas the fool, Kassel, is, you know, a reference to those of the nations. So we're comparing the two. The people of God are those who know how to walk before the living, for they have been given the light of God's wisdom. And this is where we start to see that, you know, there's something that the advantage of God's people have over the nations. In fact, in Deuteronomy 5, which we've already studied, verses 5 through 6, God, through Moses, is telling the people, I have taught you statutes and ordinances. Now, these are good things. You know, there are a lot of people that look at, well, laws, you know, rules, don't like to be restricted. But no, he says, you do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the people that shall hear all these statutes and say, surely, this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what God had given Israel, the other nations held them in high esteem. I mean, a people are known by their laws. They're known by the rules they keep, the standard that they live by. Okay? In our own nation, you know, our Constitution is considered one of the, you know, greatest living documents that have ever been put together. I mean, people generally leave other places and come here because of the way we govern ourselves, because of the laws and the rules we have. They generally don't leave here and go someplace else. Yeah. We had it was just this last week, some, you know, poor guy. I mean, if you can imagine what he was, you know, trying to do. First of all, it's you know, subject up to 3 to 5 years if you're building a boat in Cuba. This guy had to build a boat in secret, especially in a society where most people spy on their neighbors. He had to do it out of styrofoam, big pieces of styrofoam. He put it all together and spent about 3 weeks on the ocean, trying to get from Cuba to Florida. Have you ever heard of anybody trying to leave the United States that way? Okay. Well, we're known for our laws and our opportunities and everything. This is what Israel is known for. Okay. When you start dropping that and start getting away from God's word and his rule over you and stuff like that, you lose that. Okay. That's one of the blessings that God has given us. wisdom on how to direct our lives. This is why we're studying Ecclesiastes. What the eye see is better than what the soul desires. This too is futility and striving after wind. The people of God should be able to see the great things that God has granted to them. Okay, this is something that tells us to do. You know, you're a Christian? Look. You just kind of stumble through life, not taking the time each morning, afternoon, and evening to bring it to a halt and go, wait a minute. What sort of blessings has God filled this day with? What sort of things is he doing to look after me? How is he taking care of me? You know, what sort of guidance has he given me this day? Are you taking the time to appreciate all this? Especially in comparison to the evil and futility all around them. In our example, it's just, is there someplace better in this world to go than right here? If it is, please tell me about it. Okay. And that's what Israel should have seen. Where could they have gone? I mean, we're just looking in Samuel that David, almost crying to Saul and goes, why are you persecuting? You're going to force me to go and live among the Philistines. You're going to drive me away from, worship to my God. I'm going to have to live among all this idolatry. I mean, that's been great about this time. This has been, in the past anyway, a nation under God. We had him looking out for us, and he was directing the course of this country, and people were prospering because of it. God's blessings and his giving them, the ability to enjoy them, are far better than what the damaged soul desires among the pagans. Okay, since we talked about damaged souls this morning, you got to be careful about your soul and its pursuits. You can damage it that way also. You can get your soul so hungry for the wrong things, you can't turn it off. Where the body becomes used to the poisons. I mean, you get somebody who's strongly addicted to something, you can't get them to go cold turkey. It'll kill them. You got to get them off of it slowly, gradually, slowly replacing the poisons with good food. You can damage yourself that much by the wrong kind of pursuits. Whatever exists has already been named, and it is known what man is, for he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he. To make this meaning as simple as possible, sometimes the translators, I mean, it's a viable translation, but sometimes try to figure it out what they're getting at. What we want to do is go from the beginning of time, God has known what is best for man. That's simple. Okay. He created us. He designed us. He gave us a book to tell us how we work best. I mean, I guarantee you, if you buy a new car, the first thing you better do is read the owner's manual. If you don't put oil in the reservoir, if you don't put gas in the tank, if you don't keep all the fluids up, the air in the tires, and all that kind of stuff, that thing's going to go bad on you. There's a certain kind of maintenance that you have to perform. And there's a certain kind of a spiritual maintenance that a person requires. God knows, and we can't second guess him. There's no way around it. Can a man then, in his fragile and humble origin, really contend against his own design, especially that which God has decreed? I mean, he's telling us to do the things that will make us happy, to make us blessed, to make us prosperous, to make us joyous, to make us fruitful, to give us peace of mind. But trying to go around this, it's like someone deciding that they no longer want to be a carbon-based life form and are going to try eating sand to supplement it with silicon and live off poisonous gas instead of oxygen. Go ahead and try. You're designed for this planet. We're not designed to live on other worlds. Although living in the desert is like living on the moon, you have to go from an air-conditioned house to an air-conditioned car, and get through the through the territory that's uninhabitable. gives us a good idea. There are some extremes that we're not really properly fitted for. And this is what God is trying to tell us. For there are many words which increase futility. What then is the advantage to a man? The more one tries to jink with the system, we see this in pseudosciences, bad philosophies, false religions that pander to man's lust, the increasingly futile, that word, marabim, just put the word worse in there, in words also, deharim, things, or you could put it, switch it around, the worst things become. You know, when man starts playing with them, man just does not know what's best for him. This is what Jeremiah tells us, 10:23. It's not man, you know, within man that walks to direct his own steps. Let God direct you. For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years of his futile life? He will spend them like a shadow, for who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? Here's the telling argument. Last verse. Get your songbooks ready. Last verse. Here's the telling argument. No man is able to discern what is coming after the situation in which he finds himself. Okay. Why amass riches if a man has absolutely no knowledge as to whether that is what he'll really need? I mean, there's people that have been very rich. They got into trouble, and all the wealth in the world couldn't buy them out of trouble. He may require patience, but instead he has amassed gold. He may really require strength of character, but unfortunately all he has is a stockpile of silver. The situation may require Christian hope, but he has been too busy laying up uncertain riches. I mean, again, just come to the very end of life. You die and you pass into the next life. You could have acquired all the wealth in the world, but not an ounce of it is spendable in the afterlife. And we're not just talking about the afterlife, we're talking about just situations we find ourselves in. I mean, you could be, you know, collecting all the dollars you want to, and in about 10 years, the dollar may not be worth anything. You've got all of these, you know, ask somebody who collected Confederate money. It may not be spendable. But what you get from God is good for this life. I mean, this is what Paul tells us. Godliness is good for everything in the present life and in the life to come. Okay? It's good, viable currency in every job you find, every relationship you're in. Godliness is absolutely required, especially in the life to come. Thus time is spent as a shadow laying up useless things. After him refers to the situation to come after the present one, not after his death. We just talked about that. This no man can tell him. Just ask any investment counselor. Can anyone tell you what you should be putting your money into? Not lately. Most suggestions come with a huge disclaimer. Bottom line. Best to trust in God. And end of chapter 6. And then we'll unfold from there. Okay. Best investment you can make is to put your time in service to the Almighty. Okay, we're about to sing. Part of an invitation, looking through it, and something we should make an equation for. It talks about kneeling at the cross. Christ will meet you there. He intercedes for you. Lift up your voice. Leave with him you care. Begin life anew. Then goes kneel at the cross. Yeah, how do you kneel at the cross? Should be a big question in your mind. How do you kneel there? If you're not a Christian, that kneeling comes from the humble heart. Confessing Christ as Lord. Turning everything over to him. And what does the cross bring you? The flow of Christ's blood. We might put it, empties into the waters of baptism. Okay. So kneeling at the cross for someone wanting to become a Christian means obeying, the commandment to have their sins washed away. You can't come to God with your sins. And baptism is what does that. It's a washing of regeneration. You start life new. You come out of the waters, you know, into a new life. For the one that's already a Christian, it's going to God in prayer. Then Christ really does intercede for you. So does the Holy Spirit. I mean, you get all the Godhead working for you. So as we sing this song, think about these things. And if you're subject to the invitation, we suggest that you make the most of it this time. Won't you come as we stand to sing?